knew about it, as a lot of the older players have told us, a 24-year-old Astros starter named Jared Kosart grumbled to Drellich. That sort of complaint reminded Sig of another author he'd once studied, Thomas Kuhn, who in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions had written that scientific advancement is not gradual, but instead a series of peaceful interludes, punctuated by intellectually violent revolutions. Sig noted that in 2014, more than half the league's teams shifted as frequently as the Astros had the year before, in which they hadn't even led the majors in the use of the tactic. According to the stats service Inside Edge, the Rays, Orioles, Pirates, and Brewers had all shifted more than the Astros in 2013, though no one was talking about those other teams, as they weren't both shifting and losing a drastic number of games. Innovation, by definition, suggests change will be taking place, Sig said. If there's change taking place, it's not likely going to feel right. If it felt right, it would have been done a long time ago. The other criticism was that the Astros' analytics-centered approach dehumanized players by reducing each to a fungible number. That one bothered Luno, and especially bothered Sig. We realize these are human beings, not widgets, Sig said. As far as assigning a number to a person, well, I assume you get a salary? Do you feel dehumanized because your boss has put a number on you? Baseball players, they get released in harsh terms. What a horrible industry in some ways. The constraint of the system we have means that we must let some of the most skilled people on the planet go. Wasn't it better, Sig wondered, if players whose dreams are crushed know that it happened as a result of hard, unbiased evidence, and not just someone's whim? Arguably, the real backlash was against the corporatization of baseball, against bringing the strategies of shipping and logistics and management consulting to the sandlot by men who were still viewed, and might always be viewed, as outsiders. In some ways, it was no different than the pushback Luno had received within the Cardinals front office, only now that he was one of the 30 men who had the dream job of running a major league team, it came from the entire baseball world. But the backlash was also against the losing. There was so, so much losing. While Luno and Sig believed in their plan and gradually surrounded themselves with a front office that bought into it too, they fought off the notion that they fundamentally knew how to operate better than anyone else. All they knew was what they believed to represent best long-term practices, based on the information they acquired and processed, in an attempt to get more things right than wrong. We're far from perfect in everything, Sig said. Even what they believed to be the best decisions often didn't work out. Sometimes a left-handed pull hitter went the other way. Sometimes players the Astros discarded or declined to draft turned into stars. Sometimes you hit on a 16, said Sig, and if you stayed, you would have won. In his mind's eye, Sig often saw a poster his aunt had on her wall. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans, it read. It was a Woody Allen quote. He also thought of an old proverb from Denmark. He was half Danish, after all. That had over the years been misattributed to people like Yogi Berra, Niels Bohr, and Mark Twain. It is difficult to predict, especially the future. Even a long string of correct, intricately considered decisions might not turn out favorably. Luck. Sig reflected upon that concept more than anything. His parents had come to the United States searching for the American dream, and though his mother sat in the wrong stands and cheered his outs, he had already enjoyed a near decade-long career in the American pastime, because he had been fortunate enough to live in an era in which baseball had begun to value people with his worldview and intellectual gifts. If he'd been born 10 years earlier, he'd have likely lived out his days in a windowless lab instead of watching each night as his childhood fantasies, his pointer fingers flicks of the board game spinner, came to life. By the beginning of 2014, Roy Hoffhines' Astrodome sat empty and derelict. Its only patrons, the maintenance workers who ensured it didn't collapse, and the security guards who kept out urban adventurers. Modern impresarios had presented plans to turn what was once the eighth wonder of the world into a hotel, a production studio, an indoor park, a parking garage, or a convention center. They all failed. Astroworld's last roller coaster had completed its final run 9 years earlier. Meanwhile, the fate of the baseball team around which it had all once been built and the responsibility for its first World Series victory rested in the hands of a new set of innovators. What if we don't have good results? Sig said. I love my job in baseball. It would be terribly disappointing. But all we can control is the process, and I'm confident we're creating good processes and making good decisions. The rest, Sig said, is hope. Chapter 3. Graceful Beast. In the mid-2000s, the residents of Santa Isabel, Puerto Rico, had two nicknames for Carlos. One was 24/7. The other was Hitler. The first was for the way he worked to support his family, which, like many in the town of 23,000 on the island's southern coast, needed every dollar. His first construction job began at 4:30 each morning. Then, for 6 hours beneath a midday sun that permanently scorched his forearms, he worked maintenance for Santa Isabel's Parks and Recreation Department. After that, another construction job. The second, less admiring nickname, came from what he did at night. From 8:30 until 10:30 every evening, starting when his son was 7 years old, he took him out to a local diamond to run him through baseball drills. Carlos's son shared a name with him, but the family called the boy by his middle name, Javier. They drilled 6 days a week and sometimes on Sundays too. Neighbors reprimanded Carlos through their car windows as they watched Javier field hundreds of grounders and take hundreds of swings. "That's too much for a little kid," they shouted. Javier, though, wanted to be out there as badly as his father. He started playing baseball as a 5-year-old, ceaselessly flinging a ball at a concrete wall in front of his grandmother's house, even though bad caroms off tree roots blacked his eyes. "Did you get in a fight?" teachers asked him in school. Many nights, Carlos would be lying on his bed, nearly passed out after 3 shifts of hard labor, when Javier shook him awake to go to the field. Javier's father certainly pushed him. Baseball provided the glimmer of a type of life that had always been beyond Carlos or anyone he knew. Nearly 50% of Santa Isabel's families subsisted below the poverty line, Carlos's included. Carlos had gone to work when he was 13. Just 3 years later, at 16, he'd married his 14-year-old girlfriend, Sandy Bell. Their futures were already determined, so they saw no point in waiting, despite their family's objections. He was going to work construction, and he was going to support her. Sandy Bell gave birth to Javier, who was the first of their 3 children, in September 1994, when she was 16 and her husband was 18. Where Carlos had only one option, he wanted Javier to have at least 3. He could go into construction, but the father often took his young son along on his jobs to show him the grueling work it took to make maybe $50. During one sweltering summer, father and son even built an extension onto the modest house into which the government had moved them after their old one had flooded, the two of them endlessly laying concrete block after concrete block. Option 2. Javier would certainly take school more seriously than Carlos had, perhaps even go to college. The third option became obvious after it turned out that Javier was bigger and stronger and more coordinated and more driven than the other boys. "My parents taught me about the mistakes that they made," Javier said years later. "At the end of the day, it worked out pretty good for them, but it doesn't work out for most people. The way that they talked to me about life and stuff, it was like I was a man already. My dad never treated me like a little boy. He wanted me to be like him, a man at a young age who could go out and work for his family. His work, ideally, would not be in construction." Puerto Rico was once a 110-by-40-mile hotbed of major league talent. Hall of Famers Roberto Clemente, Orlando Cepeda, Roberto Alomar, and Pudge Rodriguez grew up on the island, along with other stars like Juan Gonzalez and Edgar Martinez. As recently as 2005, there were 46 Puerto Ricans on big league rosters. By 2012, there were just 18, and only Carlos Beltran and Yadier Molina had ever counted as genuine stars. Several theories attempted to explain the decline. One was that Puerto Rican children had an increasing number of options. Basketball, soccer, and even volleyball had all grown popular, and, as U.S. citizens, they could perhaps pursue traditional professions more easily. For lots of boys in somewhere like the nearby Dominican Republic, which produced 128 members of Major League rosters in 2012, there was only baseball. Another scapegoat was the draft, with its strict age requirements and compensation structure, for which Major League Baseball made Puerto Ricans eligible in 1990. The rigid system eliminated the incentive of signing a big-money deal at 16, as well as the motivation for independent local scouts to discover young talent for a cut of the proceeds. However, the average Puerto Rican draft prospect had less high-level competitive experience and less leverage than his mainland counterparts. Carlos believed his son Javier had the talent to overcome those trends, and he resolved to help him do it however he could. It would not be easy. One early problem with that plan was that Carlos knew next to nothing about baseball. He attended 3 practices when he was young in the mid-1980s when the Rio Piedras-born Ruben Sierra was emerging as a young superstar for the Texas Rangers, but he did not know how to field a ground ball. He had worked as a fisherman as a boy and tried to pick up grounders the same way he plucked crabs out of riverbeds, with his palm down. The coaches hit him balls in order to laugh at his awkward stabs, so he quit. When his son first played Little League, which is called Pampers League in Puerto Rico, Carlos listened closely to the coach's instructions and repeated them during his nightly one-on-ones with Javier. He also studied the techniques of major leaguers on TV, particularly of the era's great shortstops, Derek Jeter and Alex Rodriguez. Starting when Javier was 8, Carlos had him practice Jeter's famous jump throw from the hole again and again, thousands of times. Javier wanted to emulate those players in other ways. When he was 8, he asked his parents, neither of whom spoke English, to enroll him in a bilingual Baptist school. While Jeter and Rodriguez were always so composed in their postgame interviews, many of the Latin players seemed stilted and flustered, no matter the nature of the heroics they were trying to explain, especially when they had to do so through a translator. "Dad, I don't want to be one of those guys," Javier said. "I want to speak for myself." The tuition was $250 a month, but Carlos and Sandybell went to the pastor and asked for a break. A scholarship knocked it down to $150. To afford that, Sandybell took on a job at a water bottling plant to supplement Carlos's 3 shifts, and also started a small business in which she took photos of Javier's Pampers League teammates and sold prints to their parents. Once, driving his family home after one of Javier's games, an exhausted Carlos fell asleep behind the wheel and ran off the road. Only Carlos sustained any injuries. "He had a couple of days' rest," Javier said. After that, he went back at it. By the time Javier reached high school in 2008, he had become one of the island's best young players, tall and lean and powerful. He earned a more considerable scholarship to the Puerto Rico Baseball Academy in high school, which had been founded in Gurabo in 2001. His working hours began to rival those of his father. He woke up at 5. He waited in a McDonald's parking lot to catch a ride to the school, an hour away from Santa Isabel, at 6. He took academic classes from 8 to noon. He worked on baseball from 1 to 4. He went home and studied. At night, without fail, he went to the ballpark to drill with his father. People still came out to watch him through their car windows. Now, instead of lobbing insults at Carlos, they cheered when Javier crushed ball after ball and made throws across the diamond that reached 97 miles per hour. Professional scouts watched too, more of them each year, but still Javier had doubters, even at the baseball academy. His fellow students invited him to parties. He never went. "You're crazy," they told him. "You won't go that high in the draft." "I'm going to be a first rounder," Javier replied. "While you party, I'll be working." "They thought what they did at school was enough," he said later. "It was not enough." His family had deprived itself of so much. Sleep and social opportunities were just the start of it. To give Javier the best possible shot at living a different sort of life. Still, as he entered his senior year of high school, there remained a real chance that pro baseball wouldn't take much notice of Carlos Javier Correa Jr. Mike Elias had a background that suggested it was unlikely he would ever become a major league scout. The life of a scout was a hard one. A scout spent 8 or 9 lonely months a year on the road, during which he observed hundreds of games that few other people cared about, for a salary of perhaps $50,000 a year. A scout endured that lifestyle because he loved baseball and because he yearned to discover a player who might become a star, and most of all because he couldn't imagine doing anything else. It was a frustrating job, too. Almost all the amateurs with whom a scout fell in love would end up being drafted by one of the 29 other clubs. Elias always had other options, as did most of his classmates at Yale, who, by and large, hoped to spend their evenings in their 20s with their friends in major cities on considerable expense accounts, not alone in far-flung motels. Elias grew up in the Washington, D.C. suburb of Alexandria, Virginia. Alexandria has a median household income of around $90,000, nearly 6 times that of Santa Isabel's. Elias's childhood was comfortable, if not luxurious. His father was a Secret Service agent who protected Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, and his mother was a court reporter. He went to Yale for the education, but also because, by his freshman season in 2002, it had become a crucible not just for lawyers and bankers, but professional pitchers, too. Yale's baseball coach, John Stuper, had twirled a complete game as a rookie for the Cardinals in Game 6 of the 1982 World Series. The year before Elias arrived in New Haven, Stuper's ace was a junior named John Stites, who had a 94-mile-per-hour fastball and a diving 85-mile-per-hour slider that his teammates called the nod ball, because scouts would look at one another and nod every time he threw it. Stites' parents, Joan and Tom, were both longtime Yale professors of molecular biophysics and biochemistry. Tom would win the 2009 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his work on the structure and function of the ribosome. The rumor around campus was that the Stites had designed their only child in one of their labs. He left school a year early after the Milwaukee Brewers made him a third-round draft pick. When Elias was a freshman, he joined a rotation led by two of Stites' former classmates, Matt McCarthy and Craig Breslow. Both were considered potential pros too, though they were not as coveted as Stites had been. Elias always watched the men who sat in the bleachers with radar guns and notebooks, scribbling observations about his teammates. They were the scouts. At night, McCarthy and Breslow descended into Yale's subterranean cross-campus library to comb through scouting message boards on the internet in an attempt to assess their rising and falling prospects. Elias went with them. I was a classmate of McCarthy's and Breslow's, and I knew the quiet, observant freshman who often tagged along with them by the nickname his baseball teammates had given him. They called him the protege. Soon, as a joke, Elias began to adopt the scouts' mannerisms and lingo. He bought a pair of the Ray-Ban aviators they all wore. "Kid's got a pro body," he would say, as he watched a student lug his cello across the quad. After Yale suffered yet another defeat to a Dartmouth soft tosser, a regular occurrence that year as the team went 12-27 despite its pitching talent, Elias would break the tension on the long bus ride back from New Hampshire by referring to a scout all the players knew. "You think that junk is going to impress Anoop Sinha?" he said, of the Dartmouth kid's alleged fastball, which came in at 82 miles per hour. It was a freshman's way of amusing the upperclassmen, but like most running jokes among guys in college, it was built on a foundation of truth. Elias really was fascinated by the scouts, how they talked, how they processed what they saw, their power to grant or crush dreams, their ability to make a living in baseball, however modest, long after they could no longer play. That only increased after the Anaheim Angels selected McCarthy in the 21st round that June, and the Brewers took Breslow 5 rounds later. McCarthy and Breslow were lefties like Elias, and as a senior, McCarthy just barely outpitched his freshman rotation mate. He had a 4.04 ERA to Elias's 4.18. Elias stood several inches taller than both McCarthy and Breslow. At 6'3", he had the makings of a pro body of his own, and he still had 3 years left to improve his draft stock. Then his shoulder started to hurt. Elias tried to pitch through his torn labrum. He took 4 Tylenol before starts and became familiar with the long, thick needles that delivered cortisone shots, but even those didn't help. As a sophomore, his ERA spiked by 1.5. He knew he had to have surgery. At another school, he could have taken a redshirt season, remaining enrolled while retaining both of his 2 remaining years of baseball eligibility, the last of which he might have completed as a graduate student. But the Ivy League does not allow redshirt seasons. Elias had to withdraw while his shoulder healed. He decided to use the time off to lay the groundwork for what was now not a joke at all, but a future career. Stuber used his old connections to help Elias get an internship with the Philadelphia Phillies. He sold tickets and cleaned out rat-infested storage rooms in the bowels of the old Veterans Stadium in advance of the club's move to the newly constructed Citizens Bank Park. "Encountered some wildlife," he said, but when he wasn't doing that, he also got something more by hanging around the executive suite, a window into how a front office operated, and an impressive line on his resume. For the second half of the year, he interned in San Diego with Tom House, the former major league reliever and a PhD in sports psychology, who founded the National Pitching Association, which trained pitchers to throw with optimal mechanics. Elias rehabbed under House, but also helped him evaluate and coach the other pitchers who flocked to the program, including major leaguers like Randy Johnson and Mark Pryor. House used regression analysis to identify the mechanical characteristics that healthy and successful major league pitchers shared, like a front arm and a pitching arm that mirrored each other as they moved through space. It was the first time I'd seen somebody base their baseball philosophies off of an observed data set, rather than arbitrarily posit things and hope they worked out, Elias said. Major league executives came to visit House, too. Elias particularly bonded with one named Dan Kantrovitz, with whom he had a similar background and hoped to share a similar future. Kantrovitz had played shortstop for 4 years at Brown and then joined the baseball operations department of the St. Louis Cardinals. Though Elias returned to New Haven with ideal mechanics, his damaged shoulder never healed enough to allow him to make effective use of them. The Anoop Sinhas of the world took little notice of an Ivy League pitcher whose best season came when he was a freshman. An extended career as a pro had always been a long shot anyway. By 2006, Elias's senior season, John Stites had enrolled at Yale Law School and was soon to become a consultant with McKinsey. Matt McCarthy was at Harvard Medical School. Only the lowest picked of the three, Craig Breslow, had improbably reached the majors. He had two major league seasons under his belt and would go on to pitch 10 more, winning 2 World Series rings with the Red Sox. Elias knew he would have to follow a different path to pro ball. At the time of Elias's graduation, Moneyball was 3 years old, and front office slush piles were becoming littered with applications from Ivy Leaguers who aspired to be Theo Epstein, who had graduated from Yale 11 years before Elias. They were mostly data experts adept at exploiting statistical inefficiencies. Elias was an American Studies major. For his senior thesis, he had written a history of Tommy John surgery. If he couldn't compete with their hard quantitative skills, he felt he had a couple of advantages that might differentiate him. On-field experience and, thanks to his spring with Tom House, an idea of how to systematically evaluate baseball players that almost no other 23-year-old could have possessed. By the fall of 2006, Kantrovitz's boss with the Cardinals had begun looking for a new type of scout, one who knew how to subjectively evaluate players but was young, open-minded, and computer-literate, and who wouldn't mind chasing down some of the obscure prospects that Sig's analytical system identified. Jeff Luno hired then 23-year-old Elias as an area scout over 800 other applicants. He joined a scouting staff that by then included someone he recognized, Anoop Sinha. As his Yale classmates worked their way through graduate school or lucratively shuffled spreadsheets for investment houses, Elias spent the next 5 years on the road, mostly in the Mid-Atlantic region. He got a head start on what, for scouts, represented almost as great an achievement as discovering the next Albert Pujols, lifetime platinum status with Marriott Hotels. Luno came to trust his precociously clear-eyed analysis and sent him even farther afield. In early 2010, the scouting director dispatched Elias on a trip to Puerto Rico. That was the first time he saw a 15-year-old shortstop who immediately stood out, even in a game against players much older than he was. The shortstop was Carlos Correa Jr. When Correa entered the draft in 2012, it had been 3 years since any club had picked a first-rounder out of Puerto Rico. While the island-born infielders Francisco Lindor and Javier Baez had been selected back-to-back at 8th and 9th overall in 2011, both had previously moved to Florida. Prior to his senior year, Correa received offers to do the same, to improve his exposure and his draft stock. He declined. "I want to come out of Puerto Rico," he said. "I want to show people it can be done from here." Jeff Luno stationed Mike Elias in West Palm Beach in 2011, and also made him the Cardinals' cross-checker responsible for Puerto Rico, a recently futile assignment. The young Elias, though, had no biases against Puerto Rican players, either intellectual or experiential, and he had been keeping tabs on Correa's development. In October of that year, his interest began to peak. Correa had traveled to Jupiter, Florida, to play in a tournament at the Cardinals and Marlins' shared spring training facility there. It was the type of cattle call that has 12 fields going at once, with scouts zipping between them on golf carts. Elias was one of them, and happened to see Correa hit an opposite field line drive that never rose more than 10 feet off the ground, but that carried down the right field line and struck the foul pole for a home run. "I can't remember ever seeing anyone do that on a baseball field," Elias told himself. "Not just a 17-year-old. Anyone." He powered down his cart and watched for what Correa might do next. Luno crossed the Hilton hallway to join the Astros a couple of months later. His first new hire was Sig, but his second was Elias, his new special assistant. That winter, Elias couldn't get the foul pole's clang out of his ears. He saw Correa as often as he could and checked in frequently with Joey Sola, the Astros' Puerto Rico-based scout, who put 25,000 miles on his car's odometer each year, trying, mostly in vain, to find the island's next star. Every time Elias or Sola watched Correa, he seemed to do something spectacular. A long home run? A laser throw from the hole? "I've never seen a kid coming out of the island like this," Sola reported. Elias had never seen anyone like him either. Not in the D.C. suburbs, not at Yale, not in the mid-Atlantic region. To Elias, he resembled Manny Machado, the Orioles' soaring shortstop prospect. "This is what guys like Machado must look like when they're 17," he thought. "It became one of those gut feelings scouts talk about," he said. "One of the strongest I've ever had." In May 2012, a month before the draft, Elias filed his final scouting report on Correa. At 450 words, it was twice as long as the standard report, which embarrassed Elias. Scouts' evaluations were supposed to be concise and digestible, particularly as they were to be coded into SIG's database. But he had a lot to say. He assigned Correa a 55 grade on the 20 to 80 scale as far as his ability to hit for contact, which projected to a 272 to 287 average in the majors. He gave him a 70 for power, which projected to 35 to 40 home runs, and he graded his throwing arm an 80, the best it could be. And Correa, at 17, had more than just an acceptable pro body. "Graceful beast with large, rangy frame," Elias wrote. "Physical presence along the lines of A-Rod or Cal Ripken Jr." The key question, as Elias saw it, was whether Correa would quickly grow too big and unwieldy for shortstop, as Miguel Cabrera and Alex Rodriguez had, and move to third, where his hitting ability wouldn't represent quite as much surplus value. Plenty of sluggers could handle third base, while few possessed the combination of athletic gifts necessary to hit home runs while passably playing the more demanding position of shortstop. Elias thought Correa could stay at short. The bottom line, he wrote, upside play with chance to be top talent out of this draft class. Elias's report convinced Luno that he had better do the one thing his young scout hadn't, meet Correa and his family in person. Elias had only evaluated Correa's personality from afar, as he had once judged Yale Symphony Orchestra cellists from across the quad. "There was a way he carried himself, his posture, the way he managed his teammates," said Elias. "I remember that an article I'd read about how the Braves had scouted Chipper Jones described the same thing. His presence. This kid had that to me." But he'd never actually spoken to Correa. Luno brought along another special assistant, one he had inherited from the previous regime. The 62-year-old Enes Cabell was everything someone like Sig Meidel was not. He had played in the majors for 15 years, and though he accepted the advanced analytical methods that had begun to take over the game, he wasn't necessarily a student of them. In fact, Cabell had been a target of Bill James in an early abstract after Detroit Tigers manager Sparky Anderson insisted on playing him at first base nearly every day. Sparky is so focused on all that attitude stuff that he looks at Enes Cabell and he doesn't even see that the man can't play baseball, James wrote in 1983, a season in which Cabell hit 5 home runs in 121 games and stole 4 bases on 12 attempts. "This ball player, Sparky, can't play first, can't play third, can't hit, can't run, and can't throw. So who cares what his attitude is?" James softened his stance on Cabell in the next year's book, based in part on feedback he'd received from Cabell's agent, Tom Reich. "Everybody tells me that Enes is a hell of a good guy, and you know, you can tell he is," James wrote. "His abilities being what they are, would he be in the major leagues if he wasn't? Tom Reich insists that if the Tigers don't re-sign Enes, it will cost them 10 games next year, because they'll lose Enes's steadying influence on some of the other players. I don't deny it. I just don't have any way of knowing about it. I'm an outsider, and I find that the closer I get to becoming an insider, the harder it is to resist their distortions and misjudgments. So I spray a little acid around, make a few enemies. It helps keep me honest." Nearly 20 years later, Cabell still sometimes mispronounced the word sabermetrics, but Luno had quickly come to trust his intuition about an important quality in any young player that even James admitted he couldn't reliably evaluate, his character, known in scouting parlance as his makeup. When Luno and Cabell sat down with Correa and his parents at the Astros spring training facility in Kissimmee, Florida, after a private workout that had confirmed all of Eliza's observations about the shortstop's physical gifts, they couldn't help but notice how Correa had barely broken eye contact as he had answered each of their questions, a rarity for a 17-year-old. "This kid's a leader," Cabell told Luno. Luno, speaking the Spanish he had learned as a boy, listened as Carlos Sr. and Sandy Bell told him about 24-7 and Hitler, and about the nightly drills, and about his consistent refusal to get caught up in his peers' partying. "Because he showed signs at such a young age to be as driven as he is to succeed, that's a strong indication that it's real, and it's not something that he's doing for show," Luno said. Truth be told, Carlos Correa, a bilingual self-starter who had forced his way to the precipice of an unlikely career in pro baseball, reminded Luno of someone other than Derek Jeter or Alex Rodriguez. If Luno was still running the draft for the Cardinals, the meeting would have been enough to boost Correa up his preference list, to make him an enticing option had the clubs ahead of him gone another way. That was no longer his task. Thanks to the Astros' miserable 2011, his first ever draft pick as a major league general manager would be the first one of the first round, the 1-1. With the Cardinals, when we're picking 18 or 28, there are so many different scenarios that you can't be sure of anything, Luno said. At 1-1, you can be sure. If you like a guy, he's yours. Added Luno, all you have to do is call his name. Some years, the identity of the 1-1 is so evident that the club holding the pick has only to perform cursory due diligence before selecting him. That was the case for the Washington Nationals, who, by virtue of their recurring awfulness, had the draft's top picks in both 2009 and 2010. In 2009, the country's best amateur was the San Diego State ace Steven Strasburg. The Nationals took Strasburg. In 2010, the best amateur was the junior college slugger Bryce Harper, who, a year earlier at 16, had been billed on Sports Illustrated's cover as baseball's chosen one. The Nationals took Harper. 2 years after that, behind Strasburg and Harper, Washington began a run of six straight winning seasons. Easy. In 2012, there was no clear choice. "This is one of the most volatile, erratic, and weak drafts I can remember," a front office executive told Baseball America in May. "I've had some veteran guys tell me it's the worst ever." That might have been true down where the Cardinals were picking at number 23, but at the top, Luno, Sig, and Elias were faced with a problem they'd never encountered in St. Louis. Too many quality options, all of whom were confirmed by Sig's analysis and the Astros' scouts, as well as third-party sources like Baseball America, as locks to become Major League stars in relatively short order. Three of them, Mark Appel, Kevin Gausman, and Mike Zunino, were college players, and after 8 years of refinements, Sig's projection system for collegians had become far more accurate than it was when it spat out the name Jed Lowry. Appel and Gausman were both tall, strapping pitchers who struck out more than a batter an inning for big schools, Stanford and LSU, respectively. Zunino, of the University of Florida, was virtually flawless. While playing the game's most physically and mentally grueling position, catcher, he hit for power and walked almost as much as he whiffed, skills for which he won a rare trifecta of awards, the Golden Spikes for the country's best amateur, the Dick Houser for its best college player, and the Johnny Bench for its best collegiate catcher. The only other player to win all three awards was Buster Posey in 2008. 4 years later, Posey was a stalwart for the San Francisco Giants and was on his way to winning the National League's Most Valuable Player award. Even more intriguing was a fourth option, one who appeared to be the closest thing to Mike Trout since Mike Trout. His name was Byron Buxton, and he was a 6'2", 180-pound high school center fielder from rural Georgia who could do it all. Run, field, throw, hit for power, hit for contact. Buxton was the type of prospect that scouts called, always admiringly, a freak. He was considered the fastest amateur since Bo Jackson. He could throw a baseball 99 miles per hour and a football 82 yards. That he was a high schooler made him harder to project with certainty, though it also allowed him more time to grow. "The system works with high schoolers, but to a lesser degree," said Sig. "The information you're making sense of, there's less predictive ability. There was more of it for a high schooler from Georgia, where they played more games and against stiffer competition than one from New Jersey." The Astros' public relations staff liked to prepare bios of the club's conceivable top draft picks in advance for immediate release upon their selection. As draft day, June 4th, 2012, approached, they had several written, including for Appel, Buxton, Gausman, and Zunino. Those were the names that appeared at the top of Baseball America's mock drafts, and the ones that were generating the most buzz inside the Astros' front office, many of whose members were holdovers from before Luno's arrival 6 months earlier. As Luno, Elias, and Sig huddled in the general manager's office as the clock ticked, those outside the room figured they were deciding between the two options for whom they had really been pounding the table. Appel, if they went with a collegian, and Buxton, if they went with a riskier high schooler. "Nobody had any darn clue of who we were taking," Luno said. "Scouts all knew one another from years spent in Courtyard by Marriott bars across the country. One injudicious text message could blow everything." At the appointed hour, Luno emerged, and, for the first time with the Astros, moved a magnet to the top of the draft board. It bore the name of a player who had only recently begun appearing in the lower fringes of the top 10 on third-party mocks, never near number one. It was a stunner. The public relations staff rushed out to assemble a bio from scratch, and many incumbents in the Astros front office knew their days in Houston were numbered. Luno and his most trusted staffers had been waffling between Byron Buxton and Carlos Correa on the morning of the draft, and even as late as 6 p.m. Central Time, when they went on the clock. "They were both going to end up being great players at the end of the day," said Elias, who officially became the Astros scouting director a few months later. "If you took Cal Ripken instead of Ken Griffey Jr., it's really six of one and a half dozen of the other." "You never know if you're going to get another chance to pick first, and you want a player that can have the highest possible impact," said Luno. "For us, that was Correa. Buxton was right there, close to him. Tremendous tools. Young. Exciting. But we really felt the shortstop component of it gave Carlos the edge." Though Sig had to admit that Correa's performance metrics, mostly drawn from games against overmatched Puerto Rican high schoolers, were relatively unreliable, that only meant that his algorithms boosted the signals derived from the soft information the Astros had gathered about Correa, which came from scouting him and meeting him. Glowing reports from good scouts like Elias and seasoned baseball men like Cabell had predictive value too, and Sig's system concluded that Correa was the draft's top talent, no matter where he came from, especially because he was so young, still more than 3 months shy of his 18th birthday. Every month mattered. It turned out that a high school senior who received a virtually identical evaluation as another who was, say, 10 months older, as Byron Buxton was compared to Correa, had a surprisingly elevated chance of future success. If the Astros didn't pick Correa because it felt risky, then they would have been standing on a 16 against a 7. And if they did that, what good were they? "It's one thing to get somebody with college-level statistics to create a model," Sig said. "It's another for the decision-makers to really use it. I don't mean use it as a tiebreaker, or to throw the analyst a bone late in the draft. I mean really use it from the first pick. That's what Jeff did. I don't think we have any special insights or special knowledge, or that we're any smarter than anyone else," said Elias. "I think we're operating with information and techniques that are more or less out there in the baseball community. More than half the teams use most of the information that we use." Buxton, Zunino, and Gausman were drafted with the three picks immediately following the Astros, and Appel went eighth, so low only because clubs knew his contractual demands would be significant. Continued Elias, "The thing that can be a competitive advantage for us is having the discipline and conviction in our information to stick with it, even when it feels really wrong." There was another reason why the Astros picked Correa, how much they were going to have to pay him as far as his draft bonus. It was always a consideration, but never more so than starting in 2012. The league and the players' union had just agreed to a new collective bargaining agreement that included strict new rules about how much picks could be paid. Each club was assigned a pool of money to compensate its picks based on the sum of recommended dollars for each pick in the draft's first 10 rounds. If you could reach an agreement to pay an early draftee less than the collectively bargained bonus his particular draft slot called for, you could spend more on players you picked later. General managers like to talk about the difficulty of turning down the allure of the first million, particularly for a player like Correa, a teenager who lived in a house made of cinder blocks and who, the industry believed, was otherwise unlikely to be taken before the seventh pick, which belonged to the San Diego Padres. The Padres had sent their vice president of professional scouting, a former big league catcher named A.J. Hinch, down to Puerto Rico to watch Correa for a full week in early May, and Hinch had liked what he saw. As it turned out, Hinch said, we had no chance at him. The recommended slot bonus for the 1-1 in 2012 was $7.2 million. If the Astros could get Correa to accept significantly less than that, a strong possibility for someone like him, then they could later draft a player who had indicated he would accept only an over-slot bonus. They targeted two pitchers in particular. One was Lucas Giolito, a high school right-hander from Los Angeles, who had been a 1-1 contender before he had sprained his elbow's ulnar collateral ligament, but who could always go to UCLA if he didn't like the financial terms he was offered. The second was a Tampa high schooler named Lance McCullers Jr., whose fastball was clocked at 97 miles per hour when he was 16. McCullers was relatively well off. His father pitched in the majors for 7 years, and he had made it known that he would be happy to honor his commitment to attend college at Florida. The Astros offered Correa $4.8 million, $2.4 million less than the recommended slot bonus for the 1-1. His mother, Sandy Bell, told him that he ought to go to college. He had scored a 1,200 on his SATs and had been offered a full ride to the University of Miami. Upon hearing his wife's advice, Carlos Sr. asked for a wheelchair. Do you know how much construction I'd have to do to get $4.8 million? He reminded his son. My work, your son's work, and his son's work isn't going to add up to that. Correa accepted the offer, which allowed the Astros to also sign McCullers, whom they picked 41st overall after the Nationals took Giolito 16th, for $2.5 million, nearly double his recommended slot bonus. Luno thought he had emerged from his first draft in Houston with potentially both its best position player and one of its best pitchers, an outcome that would even outstrip what he had done with the Cardinals in 2009. Correa never regretted his decision. The Cubs, now run by Theo Epstein, had told him they planned to take him 6th overall, one spot ahead of the Padres, but he had no promises higher than that. That slot value was $3.2 million, he said. When the Astros made the offer of 4.8, which was 1.6 more, with a chance to make history as the first top pick out of Puerto Rico, there was nothing to lose when I came from nothing. Correa's graduation from the Puerto Rico Baseball Academy was scheduled for a few days after he signed his contract, but well before he'd seen a dollar from it. He was not only the school's best player, but also its valedictorian. On paper, he had secured not just his first million, but nearly his first five, but he owned just one pair of shoes and wore a borrowed suit to the draft. A family friend, the owner of a printing business, who was one of the few wealthy residents of Santa Isabel, offered to take him shopping to buy him the first suit that he could call his own, to wear as he accepted his diploma. Correa couldn't stop looking at himself in the mirror of an express in Puerto Rico, at the way the slim black garment with its silky dark blue lining clung to his body. I'm a professional, he told himself. I've accomplished what I've always wanted. As he gazed into the dressing room mirror, Correa allowed himself to envision the years to come. How even though so many still said he would soon grow too big to stick at shortstop, he would follow a strict off-season diet to stay under 220 pounds, 222 maximum, like a fighter perennially making weight. How he would give his autograph to most anyone who asked, with the same signature, quick and legible, that he had so often practiced in his school notebooks, while he waited for his classmates to complete tasks he had already finished. And how neither he nor his father would ever have to work construction again, and could soon afford to buy anything they wanted, all the shoes and the clothes they had desired but could never have. From now on, he said, I will look nice. His family knew there had never been a guarantee that such a future would be theirs, that all those nights ignoring their heckling neighbors would amount to anything, that Javier would receive the height and graceful athleticism of Sandy Bell's family, and not the stockiness of his father's, that his disciplined childhood would only build his character, not destroy it. We think that Javier has always had an angel watching over him, Sandy Bell said. The Astros had been watching him too, but he wasn't the only player who had captured their attention. Chapter 4. Growth Mindset. In 2012, the year he had moved to Houston, Sig Meidel did more than acquire a new job and a new home, if you could call his old fraternity brother's garage a home. He attended wedding number 89, his own. He'd enjoyed every ceremony he had ever attended, but he'd also analyzed what made some truly special and others less so. It's hard to find a band, as opposed to a DJ, that pleases everybody. The bridesmaids' dresses should not match the tablecloths. If you put a potted plant in a basketball hoop, guests will still know they're in a high school gym. For his own nuptials, he and his fiancée, Arati, a former journalist who had become a corporate social media manager and whom he had met at a conference, eloped to a rock off the coast of Stockholm. The officiant, provided by the Swedish government, pronounced the couple's names as Art and Sigrid, but Sig rated it very highly anyway. After that, Sig spent half his time in Houston and half working from North Carolina, where Arati and her 12-year-old son from her first marriage, Ross, lived. Ross was very much like his new stepfather had been as a boy. He was bright, a straight-A student. He loved sports, tennis, but also baseball, especially after Sig came into his life. He was small and slight. He rarely hit the ball out of the infield, and he spent most of his Little League games in right field. Unlike Sig, whose mother and father could barely grasp the difference between a ball and a strike, Ross had a parent who understood baseball pretty well. During the 26 weeks a year in which Sig worked remotely from Raleigh, he attended Ross's games. He always sat in the correct bleachers, but he spent most of the time grimacing at what he saw. The problem wasn't what the kids were doing. It was what their coaches were telling them to do. Ever since there was such a thing as the Little League, its coaches had preached the same hitting philosophy. Choke up and swing away. Ross's did too. Like every coach in Little League, they're encouraging the kids to not strike out looking, Sig said. The kids accommodate the coach by swinging at everything they can reach. It's a terrible habit. When you aren't Babe Ruth, it makes no sense. For all his good qualities, Ross was not Babe Ruth. He knew that, but as the end of middle school approached, he set an ambitious goal for himself, to make his high school's baseball team. Here was something with which Sig could help. He enlisted a friend of his from the Cardinals, a scout named Matt Blood, who also lived in Raleigh, to take turns with him pitching batting practice to Ross, and to imbue Ross with the plate discipline not of a little leaguer, but a major leaguer. It wasn't a matter of taking balls and swinging at strikes. It was a matter of identifying which strikes were worth a cut. Borderline pitches were no good. The Babe himself often couldn't do much with strikes that came in low and away, but crossed over home plate's black border. But the strikes that arrived waist high, especially over the plate's inside third? Those, Sig and Blood told Ross, were the good ones. The pitches that even a batter who was not particularly strong could drive over the shortstop's head. In his Little League games, Ross did as he had been taught. He occasionally committed the carnal sin of striking out looking. As he returned to the bench and his coach yelled at him, Ross caught Sig's eye and smiled. He doesn't know what we know, the look said. After tryouts at the beginning of the spring of his freshman year of high school, Ross anxiously scanned the junior varsity baseball team's roster. He found his name. All those extra batting practice pitches led to one unfortunate result. Sig tore his rotator cuff. Even as he underwent surgery and then endured agonizing physical therapy, he felt Ross's new swing had been worth it. He has a great growth mindset, Sig said proudly. Growth mindset. It was a phrase that would come to define baseball decisions with even higher stakes than Ross's. A superlative analytics department might get you halfway up the mountain. It was an intangible, the elusive but discoverable qualities of persistence and adaptability that got you to the top. While the Astros had badly deteriorated by the time Jeff Luno arrived, the organization still had some 300 baseball players under contract, the majority of whom had never played an inning in Houston. They filled rosters in AAA at Oklahoma City, in AA at Corpus Christi, in high A-ball at Lancaster, in A-ball at Lexington, in short season A-ball in Tri-City, in rookie ball at Greenville and Kissimmee, and in the Dominican Summer League. Luno got the job in part by promising Jim Crane he would rid his books of expensive players who wouldn't have lasted until the Astros were good again and convert them into young future contributors. In reality, the highly compensated veterans Luno inherited accounted for only a fraction of the organization's players. Heading into the 2012 season, six were due to make more than $1 million, and just two, slugger Carlos Lee and closer Brett Myers, were owed more than $8 million. What about everybody else? Luna believed that the process he planned to install, which would synthesize hard data and human experience to draw the best out of both, would help him make good decisions as far as acquiring the right players to turn the organization around via the draft, trades, and free agency, and that their analytics-aided tactics and training methods would provide those players with the tools to succeed. At a certain point, the decisions were out of the front office's hands. They belonged to the players themselves. How hard to train, what to eat, how willing they were to use those tools to determine which pitches to swing at and which to throw. That was where having a growth mindset was important. The Nerd Cave could provide a player at even the organization's lowest level with data that revealed exactly how he might improve his plate discipline or the mix of his pitches to find greater success, but that was just the start of it. It was up to the player to have the willingness to act upon that information in order to grow. That often meant changing the way he had always done things, particularly challenging because whatever these players had been doing had been good enough to allow them to get here, professional baseball. One of Luno's and Sig's frustrations in St. Louis was that they had been siloed in the scouting department. They had so many ideas for better practices the Cardinals could implement, but the other departments were run by other executives, and some of them refused to speak to Luno, let alone listen to him. Now that Luno ran everything in Houston, he controlled the decisions about the important men who would translate the front office's new philosophies to the players, convince them to use them, and teach them how to do it, the coaches. He overhauled the organization's coaching ranks, filling them with people who not only understood the plan, but were fully on board with it, even if it often violated orthodoxies in which they had previously believed. Despite the Astros' decline, Luno knew that the organization, among the 300 players it already possessed, had to have at least a few young players who, due to their natural talent and their drive to improve, might prove a part of the future he envisioned. He planned to take a wrecking ball to the Astros, but there had to be some shiny copper piping worth salvaging. "Any GM is going to inherit a system with great players in there," Luno said. "It's a matter of which ones you're going to bet on." Sig helped to guide those bets. He could run the same regressions on the Astros' own players as he always had on draft prospects, only now they were even more predictive of future success or failure. Some 140 games a year against AA pitching provided a much better data set than a few dozen against high school hurlers. He could also incorporate into his models the human observations, even the gut instincts, of coaches who knew the players far better than a scout might know a high schooler, whom he might have met a handful of times, if at all. Coaches spent every day working with the players in question and filed reports back to Houston after every game. The more Luno brought in coaches who were on board with his plan, the better the information they could pass along to Sig. Sig's models updated constantly. As the players incrementally grew, or didn't, so did their projections. Instead of indicating whether a player should be drafted, the Nerd Cave's algorithms suggested when he was ready to be promoted to a higher level of play, or to be cut. Jim Crane made his own contribution to the process. Unlike many new owners, who might want a winner tomorrow, Crane understood that Luno's overhaul would take years, which permitted him time to avoid making rash decisions on very young players, trading them, for example, for immediate big league help, that might come back to haunt him. The owner's patience also allowed the Astros to benefit from the best friend of even the most disciplined gambler, luck. There was always one player in the Astros system whom Luno was likely to keep around. The spring before their arrival in Houston, when they were still with the Cardinals, both Luno and Mike Elias had traveled to the University of Connecticut to scout a 6'3", 200-pound junior named George Springer. "He was a rare animal, a five-tool athlete in college," Elias said. "Guys with those kinds of physical tools, who throw like that, run like that, have that kind of body, they usually get signed out of high school." Guys like that were also rarely available when it was the Cardinals' turn to draft. With what would prove to be his last ever first rounder in St. Louis, in June 2011, Luno used the 22nd pick on yet another undersized collegiate middle infielder, Colton Wong of the University of Hawaii at Manoa. To Luno's dismay, if not surprise, the Astros had removed Springer from his board 11 slots and nearly an hour earlier. Springer always had the genes and the background to become a major league star. His grandfather, George Chelston Springer, emigrated from Panama at 17 in 1950 to pitch at the Teachers College of Connecticut. His father, George Jr., played in the Little League World Series, then walked on to the UConn football team before becoming a lawyer. "I peaked at age 12," George Jr. liked to joke. "Unfortunately, I didn't know that until age 18. His mother, the Puerto Rico-born Laura, was a UConn gymnast who later coached the sport. George III and his two sisters grew up on floor mats. "The flips, the twists, I could do it all," he said. In his first full season as a minor leaguer in 2012, Springer displayed every bit of that explosive athleticism, batting .302 with 24 home runs and 32 stolen bases in 128 games. He also demonstrated a trait that gave Luno and Sig genuine doubt about whether Springer would ever play a role in their club's future, even though he would enter 2013 as Baseball America's 37th rated prospect. He played completely out of control. That tendency sometimes revealed itself in the outfield, where he made as many blunders as wall-climbing catches, but more often at the plate. He swung from his heels no matter what. "I didn't have a plan," he said. "I always tried to hit a five-run homer instead of settling for the single down the middle." He was so gifted that such an approach had worked at Avon Old Farms, the boys' school to which he'd transferred as a high school sophomore, and later against Big East pitching. Springer played that way all out all the time for a reason. At 15, he had been even smaller than Sig's stepson, 5'2" and 100 pounds flat. "I wasn't the strongest, I wasn't the fastest," he said. "I was always trying to do things bigger." By the end of high school, he had grown a foot and doubled his body weight, but still maintained a little guy's mentality. "I just believed that I had to go out and give 100% of who I am every single day," he said. "I think that led to trying to do things that I couldn't physically or mentally do. I'm a pretty high-energy guy as it is. You add in having fun and competition, and you're looking at a recipe for fast." Springer's recipe produced a lot of home runs during his first year in the minors, but more often led to an outcome that Sig's metrics had always flagged as significantly negatively predictive: strikeouts. Springer strode to the plate 581 times in 2012 and retreated from it without having made fair contact after 156 of those at-bats. That computed to a strikeout rate of 1 per every 3.7 plate appearances, an obscene frequency. Only 9 regular major league hitters exceeded it that year, and they were swinging and missing against the best pitchers in the world. Springer was doing it at Lancaster and Corpus Christi, against hurlers who, for the most part, wouldn't go much further. It was hard to find a player who had struck out as often as Springer did at so low a level of play and gone on to become a major leaguer of any prominence. At the time, the major's most strikeout-prone slugger was the White Sox behemoth Adam Dunn. Dunn owned 4 of the 13 highest seasonal strikeout totals in baseball history. It was impossible to imagine a genuine big leaguer whiffing more. And yet when Adam Dunn was in single A, he had on average swung through or looked at strike 3 during just 1 of 5.5 plate appearances, a rate that was nearly 50% better than Springer's. If there was one reason for optimism to be gleaned from Springer's strikeouts, it was the nature of them. He actually had a developed sense of the plate and drew a walk every 2 games, a lot for a young player. He didn't usually swing at bad pitches. He swung at good ones. He just swung so hard that he often missed them. But Springer had more than just good genes, athleticism, and intelligence. While he hadn't had to overcome the economic deprivations of many of his teammates, he still had a strong growth mindset, the source of which revealed itself every time he tried to order at a restaurant or was called upon to speak in class, stuttering. It had started early, and by the time he was a junior at Avon Old Farms, it was debilitating. He woke up every day dreading the social interactions that lay ahead, but looking forward to his practices and games where his performance spoke for him. "The baseball field was the only place where I felt like myself," he said. For much of his youth, Springer felt lost when he wasn't on the diamond. "I just didn't think I would ever get past it," he said. "This is who I am. This is how it's going to be." Years of speech therapy eventually helped Springer realize that this wasn't true. He used many strategies. He controlled his breathing. He spoke with his hands. He seamlessly substituted synonyms on which he knew he wouldn't stumble for words that gave him trouble. Eventually, he felt little anxiety about talking in public, to the point where his inquisitors wouldn't have detected a hint of a stutter unless they were looking for it. He even became the national spokesperson for the Stuttering Association for the Young. So when his minor league coaches told him, based on directives they'd received from the top of the organization, that he had to swing softer, to hit the cutoff man, and most of all, to slow down, that wasn't quite the same challenge as the one he overcame every time he ordered a meal. He knew